I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Nancy Foley's debut novel, I Am Agatha, was loosely inspired by the life of painter Agnes Martin and the time she spent living and working in New Mexico. This time and place is where Foley's book begins, in the 1970s when our main character, Agatha, is at a crossroads of sorts, working through the logistics of where she thinks her lover, who is dealing with dementia, should spend the last phase of her life. Agatha has a one-of-a-kind voice, often prickly, and so self-assured that she simply ignores the wishes of those around her. I recently spoke with Nancy Foley about Agatha's distinctive voice and about how this fictional story was inspired with an accidental slip of family gossip. Here's our conversation. The copy of your novel that I read included a note from you. So I had the bonus of knowing the backstory as I read. Could you share that story with our listeners? Where did I Am Agatha begin for you?
Well, it began for me with the iconic art world painter Agnes Martin and an anecdote that my grandmother told me about her. Honestly, a bit of unverified gossip. Just to set the tone, a little bit of story. Agnes Martin was living in New York City in the 1960s. She had had some small success at that point, but she wasn't well known then. She also had some mental health problems. She had a breakdown. She destroyed a lot of her work and she quit painting. She left New York abruptly. She sort of disappeared for about a year and a half and later showed up in New Mexico in a small town where my grandparents lived, very near there. She leased some land. She built herself an adobe house out there on Mesa Portales. And she lived out there for the better part of a decade, sort of struggling with some things, working through them. She did get better. She started painting again. She eventually lost her lease and had to move away. But during that time in the 70s, when she was living there, I was often visiting my grandparents and so playing on that same landscape, very near where Agnes Martin lived at that time. And my family was not an art world family in any way. No one ever talked about any painters. Many years later, actually about three decades later, I was visiting my grandmother. She was quite elderly by then. And I remember that she was weeding her flower garden. And I mentioned to her, I had heard recently that Agnes Martin had lived out at Mesa Portales. And I said, did you know that this painter lived out there? And I was fully expecting my grandmother to be like, who is Agnes Martin? I was going to explain it to her. And she just very nonchalantly nodded and said, yes, I did know that. And then told me this anecdote about my grandmother's best friend and Agnes Martin and sort of a friendship that they had struck up during that time and that they had exchanged letters and that the friend's son had burned the letters after she died. And I was immediately transfixed by this anecdote, especially the detail about the letters being burned, because I thought, why would these letters need to be burned? And what kind of relationship was this? I did know my grandmother's friend very well. And I never met Agnes Martin, but they seemed to be very different people. And I just couldn't fathom this relationship. So I immediately followed up with my grandmother, tell me more. And she shut me down. She obviously, I had caught her in an off moment. You know, sometimes when people get older, they sort of lose a little bit of filter. Maybe she probably said something she didn't mean to say. She was a school teacher. She wasn't prone to gossip. She was having none of my questions. She was barely 5 feet tall, but she was indomitable. I always minded her. And she was not taking any more questions. And so I just left it. And the truth is that it was just a beautiful mystery that I carried with me going forward. I'm not an academic. I'm not an art historian. I didn't try to solve the mystery of this. I just sort of held on to it and thought about it on and off over the years. But it wasn't until about literally 20 years later, when I was older, when I was more the age of Agnes Martin in her 50s, when she was living out at Mesa Portales, that I sort of revisited that in a difficult moment that I was having. And I just connected with it in a different way. And it was pretty soon after that that Agatha's voice, my protagonist, started up in my head.
So the novel is loosely built on the life of Agnes Martin, but it is fiction. So let's begin where the novel begins. So who is Agatha and what's going on when we meet her?
Okay, so I Am Agatha, it's an unlikely romance. It's set in 1970s in New Mexico. Agatha is a formidable, crotchety abstract painter. She's in her 60s. She's sort of looking to get out from underneath some personal problems that she's having. So she leases land on a remote mesa, builds herself an adobe house. All she wants is to be left alone out there to work through her problems, to make her art. Instead, she falls for a mild-mannered widow, a small-town widow named Alice, who's different than Agatha in almost every way. And Alice has her own secrets, but they fall in love. And the story takes place somewhat later, over sort of a strange span of days. Alice is very deeply rooted in the town. She's lived there her whole life. Agatha is viewed as an outsider in many different ways. But Alice has a deepening case of dementia, and this is starting to become problematic for her daily life. And a conflict develops between the two, between the town and the two women about what should happen with Alice. Where should she live? Who should she live with? The two women just want to live their own lives and be together, but other people, particularly Alice's son, have a different idea. I'll stop there because there could be a lot of spoilers, but I will say, I think it's a little bit dark. It's a little bit funny. I think it's a little bit funny, offhandedly funny. And it's about art, love, and aging, basically.
So the first time I read the echo of the title was in this sentence from Agatha as our narrator. I stand up, irritated, because I am not a feminist. I am Agatha. So Agatha had a suffer-no-fools way about her. Did her voice speak clearly to you as you wrote?
It did. And it came to me, honestly, very naturally, very easily. That was the one part of the book that I did not struggle with, was her voice. I guess she is a little bit of an alter ego for me. I can't explain it, but she really, I think I'm generally a fairly quiet, polite person, but her voice just really erupted out of me. It was also a time of, when I was writing it, it was a time of great restraint in a lot of ways. I started writing it during COVID. It was lockdown. My two children, who are young adults, were living in a small house with us, and there wasn't a lot of space. We were all trying to behave and do the right thing and all this kind of stuff. And I was kind of losing my mind. And I would go out to my garden shed, which is my office, and I would write in Agatha's voice. And it was just really liberating to sort of let loose. And I also did channel, you know, I had a friend who I did channel. She had died of cancer in 2017. This was an unresolved conflict for me. We'd been estranged for maybe 15 years before that. And she was a very difficult person. You know, sometimes you have a difficult friendship in your life that affects you in certain ways, good and bad. And sometimes when I'd be writing Agatha and I'd be like, what would she do now? And I would think of that friend, what would my friend do? And I would kind of channel that. But I would say that the most delightful part for me of the writing was just Agatha's voice, just writing that voice.
Have you listened to the audiobook?
I haven't yet. I have not listened to it yet.
Well, I have. I listened as I read, and I did think, I loved the way the actor personified the voice, and I'm wondering, after you listen to it, if it okay. You know, if it was the way you imagined. But we'll find out later. So let's talk about the setting. It's 1970s New Mexico, Mesa Portales, and the setting is essential to the story because, like you said, it's where Agatha builds her home, and it's remote compared to the bustling cities where her art is shown. And you mentioned visiting your grandparents in this area. So how did you approach writing this setting? Because I could feel the love when I was reading about it.
Yeah, it really is. The New Mexico landscape is really the landscape of my heart. I grew up about 2 hours from where my grandparents live. But it was only 2 hours away, still in New Mexico, but it was like a world away. It was in Los Alamos, which is the, you know, where they had the Manhattan Project. And, you know, to get to Los Alamos, you drive about an hour north from Santa Fe on a windy road. Until for quite a while after the war, there was still a military checkpoint to get in. There was a high fence. It's on a finger mesa, a high plateau. It's not only sort of physically separate from the rest of the state, it's also culturally separate. And, you know, they're growing up, there's just so many jokes about Nobel Prize level minds, like shoveling their own driveways and, you know, doing all this kind of thing. But there's definitely a darker current, which is nuclear weapons, environmental concerns, impact on surrounding communities. And to live there is a little bit uncomfortable, I would say. And when I was growing up, I didn't really understand what that feeling was, but I felt it. And when I left for college, I did sort of understand that more and what an unusual place it was to grow up. So I just felt a little bit of an outsider in my own state, I would say. But we would spend a lot of time at my grandparents, and that was very different. They were very rooted in their community. My grandmother was a teacher. My grandfather did various things. He worked for the BLM. He worked on the reservation. He owned a cafe in town. And the landscape there is a little bit different. It's redder. It's oranger. It's really like what a lot of people can, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe country. Abiquiu's not too far from there. And it's just gorgeous. And I just, there was so much outdoor time there, so much rootedness there that I didn't always get in Los Alamos. And so I just have a really abiding love for that landscape. And I've spent probably 30 years writing sentences about that landscape and writing them over and over and over. And a lot of them have ended up in this book. And I just try to communicate things about the landscape, I would say, without saying them directly. I always try to communicate something indirectly or an offhand way so that it's more of a, it's not so much of a description as it is a feeling. That's what I try to do.
You mentioned Georgia O'Keeffe, and Agatha is friends with her in this book, although Georgia never appears directly in the book. How did keeping Georgia at a remove help you tell this story?
Well, Georgia O'Keeffe seemed like she's an overwhelming presence in New Mexico. I mean, to be fair, she blots out the landscape for a lot of other artists in the area. And obviously a big personality. You know, there's a little bit of, I would say, like a Georgia O'Keeffe industrial complex. There's a museum, there's a gift store, there's merchandise. I love her work. So nothing about that. And she was a very talented and strong woman and an artist. And, you know, all of that is amazing. But to take her on, I had no interest in that. And so to keep her a little bit off stage, and while at the same time poking the bear a little bit, because I have noticed that when you talk to people about Georgia O'Keeffe, especially people who are not from New Mexico, there's a deep reverence, you know what I mean? And a feeling that she would be the most wise, peaceful elder that you ever encountered. And I think she was actually, you know, in her own way, quite ornery and had to be very determined about how she lived her life. And so I did have a lot of fun just having her be sort of a smaller character in the book and having her be kind of a frenemy, honestly, to Agatha. So I did enjoy that. But yeah, she's a real person, and I kept her as a character in the book, whereas Agatha, you know, is not Agnes Martin. I mean, none of the things that happened in the book happened in that main action of the book happened to Agnes Martin. So
now Alice is a primary character, but she's often at a remove. We know her from Agatha's perspective. And as you mentioned, she has memory issues. She has dementia, which makes the reader question the reliability of what we think we know. We only hear her first person point of view through a letter she's written to Agatha. Talk to me about this letter and why you included it.
Well, you know, basically the book is a monologue by Agatha. It's in the first person. And so this, you know, I got to do the thing I wanted to do, which was the voice, her voice. It's all her voice, but it does create narrative problems, especially when the personality narrating the story is such a big personality as Agatha is. And she's so opinionated, she can sort of overwhelm everybody else. And so that was my biggest problem. One of my biggest problems in writing this book was how to bring other people in and have her not have her opinion of them, not just flatten them. And it was very difficult in terms of Alice, because when the action starts, she does have dementia. She's off scene, you know, and I just felt like I really need to bring her voice in. But the action is also, it's in present tense. You know, there are some flashbacks and that kind of thing, but mostly it's like first person, present tense, moving forward, always moving forward. And so it was difficult to do. So I decided that I would do one letter and just try to put as much as I could into the letter while still having it be hopefully somewhat of a realistic kind of letter that someone would write. Yeah. But I was trying to solve a problem, because that's kind of what writing a novel turns out to be, is solving all kinds of problems that you didn't know you had.
So Agatha strikes up a friendship with a local boy, Josie, who helps her make bricks for the house that she builds and any other task that she enlists his help with. The two are an unlikely pair. Talk to me about their relationship.
you know, they have a very large age gap between them. And I have always had a lot of older friends, like much older friends. I feel very interested in them. I feel safe around them. I have worked in an old folks home before. Both my grandmothers were very important people to me. My biggest artistic mentor was a painter. I've never had a writing teacher or a writing mentor, but a painter 30 years older than me, or actually more older than that, 40 years older than me, was really helpful to me. And so I would say that Agatha and Josie in this book have the same sort of age gap. Josie is a lot younger, but I am very interested in those kinds of relationships between people, especially when they're not related. You know, they're not a grandparent, grandchild situation. I've been fortunate to have older people in my own life who are interested in me and have brought things to my life that have really been enriching. And I mean, obviously, Agatha, in a lot of ways, Agatha is, you know, she's not the most mature. And so she does connect with Josie maybe on a level closer to Josie's age in some ways than would be typical. But I have two kids. I really enjoy interacting with kids that age, that were Josie's age in the book. And I find a lot in there. And there's always a lot of humor, you know, between disparate generations that you can bring to it. So.
With the exception of Josie and then another character, Dan, Agatha really has no use for men. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, she doesn't. I don't know what to say about that, except it did. She has no use for them. It's true. I mean, not that she's completely against them, although she does seem to be that way a lot, but they haven't brought a lot to her, I guess you could say. And it's not who she's interested in. And she follows her interests. You know, she doesn't waste time with people she's not interested in. And I think I would say that the lawyer in the book probably has grown on her quite a bit, but she tends, I would say, to underestimate, maybe not always correctly, but any man in the story she's not impressed with. Like they just right off the top, they would have to do something to impress her for her to give them the time of day. And that's just sort of a default for her. Yeah.
I want to come back to Agatha's inspiration, Agnes Martin. When writing this book, where did the reality end and the fiction take over, and how did you decide where that point would be?
So the only real realities are some of the things in her past, I would say. You know, as I mentioned, you know, there is a section in the book that's kind of about how Agatha ended up in New Mexico. And there are points in that that are true, you know, being in New York, having a mental breakdown, arriving to New Mexico, building a house at Mesa Portales. Those are all true. And there would be smaller details along the way. But I never imagined writing a book about a novel about Agnes Martin, a novelized story of her life. So I really did just, people have asked me this question, sort of, what was your organized plan for how much of Agnes Martin's life you were going to incorporate? And I will say it was completely, I picked and chose as I wanted to creatively out of a kind of creative ruthlessness, whatever fit my story, to be honest. And I knew some things about Agnes Martin. I already loved her paintings. They bring me great solace. They're beautiful. But I did not want to be tied to her biography in any way. So once I realized what I was writing, I did not do more research. I have never heard a recording of her voice. I have read a couple of biographies. I don't know anyone that knew her. I tried to just sort of pick up a little bit on that particular situation, that particular moment in her life, and sort of the energy of her that I had heard about. And that's mostly what other than that, I sort of just chose for my own purposes. Yeah. And I've had a lot of angst about that, actually. Like, is that fair to do? But that is what I did. So.
You explained in that letter that accompanied the book that I mentioned that you resisted tracking down the son of your grandmother's friend. Is that still the case?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that is just that I didn't want to tie in any way. This was something my grandmother said off the cuff, and I have no idea the veracity of it or what it actually meant. The past is such a mystery. You know what I mean? Lots of times it's just something that you can't even fathom. Like it gave me an idea, a creative idea, but the truth of it, I don't know. So I would in no way want to tie any of that to the actual person, Agnes Martin, also my grandmother, from beyond the grave, I'm sure would disapprove, and I would feel that. So
I asked earlier if Agatha's voice came to you clearly. Does it stick with you since completing the book? Do you still hear her?
Yeah. I mean, I've come to realize that it is really a lot of my just sort of the I don't mean my private opinions, but sort of the energy of it, I think, are very much a part of me. You know, I have written 4 manuscripts before this. I never showed them to anyone. This is over the course of like 25 years. And I just never felt that any of them were very good. But I was writing about landscape all those years, you know, but it's not enough to write about landscape. You have to have a story as well. And when this sort of my grandmother's anecdote came together with the landscape, you know, then suddenly I had 2 characters on a landscape, and I didn't know what the story was. I had no idea, but I put them on the landscape and I started writing scenes around them. And I would say that Agatha's voice is really, to a large degree, my voice and my opinions sometimes about things. And so it doesn't go away. It's still tracking in my head all the time, I would say. Just sort of suddenly was realized. I was able to put it on the page.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from I Am Agatha?
Yeah. So first of all, it's kind of a shorter novel. And I'm a big believer that this is just a purely, you know, different opinions on this topic. But if you're going to have a short novel, I like it to be surprising in some way. You know what I mean? Not just a mood piece, but surprising in some way. And then also, I feel like lots of times I don't know what I think about things until I write them down as if I'm sort of hidden from myself. And I didn't know I was writing a book about becoming older and thinking about death and aging and these kinds of things and love and what is possible when you're older. But what I hope that people take away is I hope they have fun reading it, number one, because I read primarily for pleasure and I hope someone gets pleasure out of reading this book, but also just sort of the possibilities of what is possible when you're older in terms of love and changing your life and doing different things. You know, I know that I have aging parents. A lot of people I know have aging parents. There's a lot of difficulties around a lot of these situations. And a lot of the sort of conversations are about medical issues and, you know, just sort of arrangements and this kind of thing. And it can be very sad, and people are dying and friends are dying and that kind of thing. But I think there's, you know, while you're alive, you can live. And I always try to remember that. And I had the painter that I mentioned, who is my mentor, one time he told me it was the last time I saw him before he died. And he was 90 then. He did die when he was 94. And he said to me, I'm so glad to see you. I had gone to visit him. And I used to go over to his house for 30 years and look at paintings. He taught me how to look at paintings, and mostly just by giving me the space and the silence to look at them. And he said, I have good tidings from the far side of life. And I was a little bit taken aback by this sort of biblical phrasing, but I was waiting. And he said, I just wanted to tell you that, you know, I was listening to a Chopin Nocturne today. He listened to classical music while he worked. And he said, and I heard something in it for the first time. And he's been listening to this for decades. And he said, I heard something in it for the first time that I've never heard before. And he said, and I just want to tell you that if I hadn't lived long enough and listened well enough, you know, and lived widely enough, I would have never heard this thing. And to him, it was like, he was so happy about it. He was joyful about it. It was that, you know, he was a painter. He's a great painter, but music was his art, his consolation, his sort of parallel track of what he went to for art. And he was equally invested in music. And so for him to have been listening to this music for decades and suddenly hearing when he was 90, something that he'd never understood about it before was thrilling to him. And he said, don't ever forget that it's so lucky to grow old, you know, that there are still things ahead for you to experience that are joyful and new and things you didn't know before. And you have to live long enough to get to them. So I guess that's a long answer, but that's kind of what I hope, that, you know, Agatha does change in the book. She learns a thing or two and will hopefully do things a little bit differently moving forward. And I don't know, as I get older, I try to remember all those things as well.
Well, the book is I Am Agatha. Nancy Foley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I Am Agatha was published by Avid Reader Press. And now, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a debut novel that reveals itself little by little through a collection of narrators and keeps you turning the pages.
It's best to go into Patmina Sabat's debut novel, Good People, with very little besides the vagaries of the jacket copy. Zora Sharaf could do no wrong. Zora Sharaf brought shame upon her family. What's the truth? Depends on who you ask. We learn through a kaleidoscope of oral history-style narration that the story centers on the Sharaf family. The family immigrated to the U.S. from Afghanistan more than 20 years earlier with little more than the clothes they were wearing. But patriarch Ramat Sharaf worked his way into financial and social success. The family maintains connections to the Afghan community in their Virginia town, even as they personify the American dream. They live in an exclusive neighborhood. Zora Sharaf and her older brother Omar attend the best schools. Their father wants them to advance to top-notch colleges and become even more successful than him. And then Zora begins to rebel against her culture and bring shame to her family. I'm going to stop there with the major plot points because the joy of this novel is the way Sabat unpacks the story and reveals information little by little, from a cacophony of voices that range from friends and neighbors to school officials and newspaper articles. Interestingly, none of the accounts are from the family members themselves. For much of the first part of the novel, we know something tragic has happened, but we don't know exactly what. The author uses a varied timeline and the aforementioned choir of narrators to build suspense and keep us turning those pages. Fans of Liz Moore's The God of the Woods will love this novel, which is another literary mystery thriller that keeps you wondering and guessing until its final pages. With ultra-short chapters and well-timed cliffhangers, Sabat paints a portrait of an immigrant family dealing with the pressures of preserving their culture while also trying to fit in. It is a master study in how the same collection of facts can be interpreted in vastly different and often opposite ways. It's hard to talk about Good People without revealing too many plot points, and you really should experience this by just trusting Sabat's masterful writing and letting her guide you through. It's a crime mystery that also speaks to issues of gossip, stereotypes, misconceptions, and societal divisions. And it's addictive in all the best ways. I consumed this nearly 400-page novel in a little over two sittings, relishing its energy and guessing and then guessing again about what it means to be good people. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Good People by Patmina Sabat was published by Crown. Next week, we speak with Bar Friedmantel about her debut novel, Honeysuckle.
So Honeysuckle is a very loose retelling of a story from Welsh mythology. And it's about a girl made of flowers who must be rewoven at the end of each season or she'll fall apart. And a lonely boy who will do anything to save her and stop the cycle of bloom and decay, including a lot of things he really shouldn't.
That's next week on Marginalia. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Maybe you already know about naked short selling. Maybe you personally shorted stocks yourself. But do you know about the time short sellers ruined a Super Bowl, basically?
For me, I was a little late, but red flags went up like, what is going on? This is really scary.
At Planet Money, we get the story behind the money to explain how money works. Listen on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.